Welcome to Asian Oscar Bait, the podcast where we remind Hollywood that Asian people need to be seen, heard, and paid for generally being awesome.
Every week, we're going to tell you a story of a real-life Asian from history.
But before we get to the storytelling, let's take a moment to talk about Asians in the media. So it is perpetually a bad time for Asians in movies. But a good number of the Asian American community holds its breath whenever a new Marvel Comics property comes out. For those of you who aren't aware, Marvel did a great job with its new series, Luke Cage, which is about a black bulletproof superhero in Harlem, and it's pretty fantastic from what I've seen. Unfortunately, their portrayal of the African American community is a lot more nuanced than anything the Asian community has received so far. There's a cool Chinese couple in Luke Cage that owns a restaurant, but it's not like they get that much screen time or depth of character.
In comparison, we have Daredevil Season 2, which promised a badass antihero with Elodie Young's Elektra and ruined it by literally having zombie ninjas running around terrorizing people in Manhattan. Also, the main white guy spends the whole season crying about how he's never killed anyone before, but he set a Japanese man on fire in the previous season. Are Asians not people? We also got a trailer for Iron Fist this month, which is the next Marvel Defender series. For those of you who don't know anything about Marvel, aka Matthew, Iron Fist is about a white man named Danny Rand who goes to a mystical Asian land and obviously becomes amazing at martial arts. So that's what it's like in the comics, and there was a big Twitter campaign to get an Asian person to play Danny Rand, but instead we got some white flop from Game of Thrones, who, by the way, I saw on Tinder under an assumed name even though it was connected to his official Instagram. I swiped right on him to tell him off for playing this role, but he did not even match with me. So he has bad taste in both movies and women. Literally everyone else in the show is Asian. And if you watch the trailer, it's very mystical and like, ooh, oriental, if you know what I mean. Luckily, we have about a year to go before its release. Unluckily, Marvel's Doctor Strange movie is coming out on November 4th.
So this film has Benedict Cumberbatch playing a doctor named Stephen Strange who gets injured in an accident and goes to a far-off land to learn about magic and to heal himself. In the comics, it was a Tibetan monk called the Ancient One who helped him. They've replaced this monk with, my god, Tilda Swinton. But in the comics, Doctor Strange also has a servant called Wong, who is played in the film by Benedict Wong.
Benedict Wong is one of my favorite actors ever, and for that reason alone, I will go see Doctor Strange. The director of Doctor Strange is a man called Scott Derrickson, who also co-wrote the film. And in the comics, there are two Asian characters, which are Wong and the Ancient One. So there was a bit of backlash over how he cast Tilda Swinton as the Ancient One. And in order to backtrack about what he's done, his whitewashing basically, he said, to avoid the stereotypical magical Asian, we cast Tilda Swinton. But having eliminated one of the Asian roles, I had to bring Wong back in. Unlike the Ancient One, Wong could be totally reinvented. What we did with him was essentially invert the stereotypes from the comics. In the comics, he's a martial arts kung fu sidekick manservant. In this version, instead of a manservant, he's a master sorcerer, and instead of a sidekick, he's Strange's intellectual mentor instead of just a fighter. Benedict Wong, who plays Wong, agrees that his character is really different and said that he was pleased they'd gone in that sort of direction, and they're doing a modern update. He says, it's a really positive step that this character is fighting alongside Strange. But the key word, of course, here is step.
I'm a bit wary, well, more than a bit wary, about how Derrickson's approach to combating a stereotypical character is to just completely erase the character and rewrite it as white. I mean, I understand that logic, but I just don't think it's really useful to take what was traditionally an Asian character instead of maybe advancing the character or imbuing it with some complexity and erasing it of its stereotypes. You instead cast one of our greatest living actresses, but it's still, you know, it's just a weird sort of solution to something that could be.
Like, what I don't understand is he says, like, oh, we could not, like, reinvent the Ancient One character because it was at its core a racist character. But he says that it's totally fine to reinvent Wong. I just don't really see what's stopping him. I mean, I've never read the comics. Apparently they're really racist, even according to this director, so I never will. But you know, like, I really don't see, there's really no need to be so subservient to the canon if the canon isn't appropriate.
Yeah, I think that's Marvel's problem in general, is sort of just kowtowing to the MC universe or whatever it's called. I mean, I may be one of the, like, last people on Earth to, I just feel like I have, like, my knowledge
what
of Marvel is as slim
as
possible.
Have you seen any?
I've seen some movies. I just don't.
One Iron Man movie.
I've seen two. Okay. Watch it, Melissa. I've seen two. But yeah, I don't know. I just feel that I think Marvel has a long way to go, and that, you know, it's, you can tell that they're trying to diversify and to become a more inclusive storytelling company. I mean, they have Black Panther coming out, and I mean, from the looks of that, just in terms of who they have in that cast, it looks pretty phenomenal. I think every actor they've announced so far is Black. It's a bit unfortunate that they're really in the news a ton of the time for how much they've fucked up their casting, regardless, like in shows like Iron Fist or in movies like Doctor Strange.
Yeah, what's bizarre is that, like, the comic book world has actually caught up a lot. Like, yeah, the current Amazing Hulk, I think, it's not Incredible Hulk anymore, is Asian. His name is, like, Amadeus Cho, I think.
Is it?
Yeah.
Wow.
And we have Ms. Marvel, obviously. So the comics are doing really well and they're catching up, but
yeah, I guess the movies and TV creators just seem a bit indebted to past visions, I guess, just to please. It's like the Ghostbusters thing of pleasing fanboys who are so accustomed to a certain image or a certain look of these characters that they're not willing to budge on any other thing.
Mm-hmm. And the other thing that I'm really worried about is the, you know, the Oriental mysticism. Ugh. And I just keep wondering, like, is there any way for this to not be racist if you have, like, these overtones in the first place?
Yeah, I mean, we've seen how Tilda Swinton looks in this movie. She's clearly modeled after
a Tibetan monk.
Yeah, I mean, it's you know, you can make that character white, but they've clearly not shaved it of its Asian origins.
Yeah, I mean, I feel like one of the only ways they could have done this, because the problem with my big problem with Orientalism and mysticism in comics and stuff where people use, like, magic, and this is exactly the same case as Iron Fist, is that the main character becomes, is white, a white person, and becomes, like, what they call the mighty whitey trope, which is when they become better at being a mystical Asian than actual Asian people. So really the best thing Scott Derrickson could have done was cast an Asian person as Doctor Strange.
Yeah, I'm still waiting. I think everyone is still waiting to see a Marvel movie where an Asian actor is not simply cast to better the journey of the white protagonist.
Hashtag starring John Cho.
Yeah.
In today's episode, I'm going to tell you the story of a man who would become known as the Donut King. The year 1967. In the midst of the Vietnam War, the neighboring Cambodia was trying its best to remain neutral. Freshly independent from France's colonial conquest, the monarchy was caught in a pressure cooker of political tensions. By helping both northern and southern Vietnam, the king angered both United States and Cambodia's growing Communist Party, the Khmer Rouge. In 1967, America was secretly dropping bombs all over Indochina, peasants were uprooted from their villages, floods were destroying crops, industrialization was speeding up, and the spirit of revolution was growing. Under the cloud of all this chaos, in 1967, Bun Tek Noi fell in love. Born and raised in a rural village bordering Thailand, Bun Tek was a Chinese Cambodian, which meant that he was one of the lower classes. His mother sent him to the capital, Phnom Penh, to go to school and hopefully make something of himself. It was there that he met Shiganthini Cohen. Unlike him, Shiganthini was from a very good family. Her father was a government official, and her brother, head of police, would briefly become president. But that didn't matter to Bun Tek Noi. Living just a few blocks down from the Kuen mansion, Bun Tek climbed onto his roof and played the flute each night, hoping the sounds would carry to Shiganthini's room. One day, he managed to pass a note to Shiganthini through her family's maid. He told her that he was the flute player, and a week later, he received a response, and thus began a love-struck correspondence. Bun Tek wanted to visit her in her mansion, but it was impossible for someone like him to be with someone like her. Playfully, Shiganthani dared him to try and sneak in. To her shock, one stormy night, she heard a knock on her bedroom door and opened it to see Buntak covered in rain and blood. He had slid under barbed wire, dodged guard dogs, climbed over a wall, and crawled through a window before having to guess where her bedroom even was. For 45 days, he lived with her, hiding under the bed whenever someone entered. At night, they would sometimes sneak out together and drive on a motorcycle through the city. On their 30th night together, they swore an oath to one another, cutting their fingers, letting the blood drip into a cup of water, and sharing it under the moonlight. One day, the Kuhn family discovered Buntak. The couple wanted to get married, but the Kuhns wouldn't allow it. They arranged for Buntak to break off the relationship with Shiganthani, making him claim he didn't love her while they hid behind a curtain. It was like a scene out of Shakespeare. Buntak told Shiganthani he didn't love her, then retracted his statement, said it was a lie, took out a knife, and stabbed himself. Shiganthani's father immediately called an ambulance, while the rest of her family knocked Shiganthani in a room. Upset that she might never see her loved one again, she took a bottle of sleeping pills and went into a coma. Realizing that they were killing these two young lovebirds, the Kuhn family finally allowed them to marry. And with their help, Buntak's status increased, and he and his family were moved to work out of Thailand's Cambodian embassy when the civil war began. In 1975, Pol Pot and the Khmer Rouge came to power. In the genocide that followed, 25% of the Cambodian population would die due to forced labor, torture, disease, and execution. Fortunately for Buntak Noi, Shiganthani, and their three babies, they were safely able to leave for America. They arrived at Camp Pendleton in San Diego, California, among the first wave of Cambodian refugees. They had lived a good life in Asia, but here they were destitute and barely able to speak the local language. Buntak worked at a gas station to support his family, and it was there that a coworker brought in a box of donuts. Buntak had never seen one before, but tasting it, it reminded him of a childhood snack. As the days passed, he noticed that the donut shop across the street, DK's Donuts, received customers at all hours. So after work, he went to the shop and asked the women working there how to open a donut shop. They recommended that he get a job training at Winchell's, California's largest donut chain at the time. Despite his poor English, Buntak's friend, who first introduced him to the donuts, wrote him a recommendation that got him a position there. He cleaned the store, baked the donuts, handled the money, and learned English. He quickly became a customer favorite and changed his name to Ted. One day, a customer showed Ted a classified in the paper, saying that a donut shop was for sale in La Habra. It was called Christie's Donuts and cost $45,000. Ted only had $20,000, but the previous owners of Christie's loaned him the balance. Shiganthani and his nephew helped him run the shop, pay off his loan, and eventually they managed to purchase a second shop in the franchise. At this point, Shiganthani picked an English name too. She named herself Christie. By 1980, Ted owned 20 Christie's Donuts in Southern California. He would watch existing shops that were for sale, sit in his car, take notes on how many customers arrived and when. If he decided it was worth it, he would take it over, run it for a month, and then leave, allowing the old employees to keep working there. He also began sponsoring visas for hundreds of Cambodian refugees who were desperate to escape Pol Pot's murderous regime while the UN and other countries refused to help. Ted would buy shops and lease them to Cambodian families, teaching them baking, customer service, some English, and managerial skills. He co-signed loans, he advocated for their permits, he helped them apply for Social Security, find housing, and, of course, he also gave them their first taste of a donut. Ted, whom everyone would call Uncle, became a millionaire. At his peak, he owned 70 donut shops. The Noyes bought a 7,000-square-foot house in the OC and joined the Republican Party. Ted would convince Asian immigrants to join the Republican Party, confident that business was their way forward. Ironically, Ted would end up meeting Richard Nixon at a Republican event. They were friendly. Ironic why, you ask? Of course, it was Nixon who led the secret bombings in Cambodia without congressional approval. Despite his success, Ted became depressed. He would be quoted as saying, "No political life, no religious life, just work, work, money, donuts, sleep." So he went to Vegas. Well, he'd been to Vegas a few times before with his family. They saw Elvis Presley perform the first time they went, and thus began Ted's love for gambling. He would go back every few months, closer and closer in length each time, lying to his wife about where he was going. Between Tom Jones and Diana Ross performances, Ted was showered with affection and free things from the bosses of Caesar's Palace, the MGM Grand, and the Mirage. The Donut King was finally living like a king. He sank deeper into debt. Christie would chase him to Vegas with her youngest son, running from hotel to hotel to find him. On one occasion, Ted remembers hiding in shame from his family in the maze of card tables and glowing slot machines in Caesar's Palace. He tried to stop. He joined a Buddhist monastery in D.C., but when he returned, he started gambling. He joined a Buddhist retreat in Thailand, where he was not permitted to speak or wear shoes, his feet bleeding as he walked on the rocks, begging for food on the sides of roads with fellow monks. When he returned, he started gambling. He joined a Gamblers Anonymous club, and in his own words, "I cry, everybody cry, after cry, go back gambling. Monks cannot help me. Buddha cannot help me." People who he once helped began to avoid him like the plague, scared that Uncle Ted would ask for a loan. He sold his mansion, and that's when an opportunity appeared. 1993. Cambodia's worst struggles had tided over, and they planned to hold free elections for the very first time. Ted eagerly flew back with his family, happy that he could finally, maybe, make a difference and become a politician. Unfortunately, his party didn't win a single parliamentary seat, though out of goodwill, he became an economic advisor to the prime minister. He actually negotiated a significant trade agreement that created thousands of jobs in the garment industry. But he'd lost all his money. He was still depressed, and when Christie flew to the States for a grandchild's birthday party, Ted met a young woman and moved her into his house. Christie divorced him and never returned to Cambodia. Dramatically, Ted would end his political career in 2002, where, at a news conference, he accused the government of corruption and dissolved his party. Then his new wife left him. Alone and homeless, Ted tried currying favor from associates in the States and in Cambodia. The only one who showed him kindness was a government minister who allowed Ted and his children to sleep on the porch of his vacation home, but never go inside. The Donut King. He believed he was being punished by God for breaking the blood vow he made to Christie when they were young. Ted was quoted as saying, "I don't know who I am right now. I say, Ted, who are you? I really don't know." And as for Christie, in an interview with the Los Angeles Times, she mused, "Once, I said I would die if something happened to him. Now, our romance is so distant, it's as if it happened to somebody else." In 2014, the California Sunday Magazine wrote an incredible piece about the current fight between Dunkin' Donuts and Cambodian mom-and-pop donut stores in California. They profiled Ted Noy and tracked him down to Cambodia. He is rebuilding his life, having offered business advice to young entrepreneurs and helping push them to success. At 74, he is a rich man once again, working in real estate and in love with his 19-year-old girlfriend. He has not been to a casino in years. I imagine that part of Ted Noy's depression and spiral into gambling addiction is that he never felt like anything was enough, that he was never doing enough. I mean, did he ever realize what a difference he made to hundreds of Cambodian families in California? 200,000 Cambodians fled to the United States, around half settling in Long Beach. And now, something like 80% of donut shops in the Los Angeles area are owned by Cambodian Americans. An article in the New York Times from 1995 describes it as a primary route into the local economy for Cambodian immigrants. In that article, they quote one refugee who also fled the genocide, and he stated that he came to California at 2 in the afternoon, and at midnight, he learned how to bake donuts with his friend. the first English words he learned, twist, glazed, jelly, chocolate, buttermilk, and old-fashioned. This is an important story. This is an exciting story. This is what I would have rather seen than Wolf of Wall Street, a film by Martin Scorsese that chronicles the rise and fall of an entrepreneur by the name of Jordan Belfort. I mean, as much as I enjoyed that film, I think it really fails because Jordan Belfort, Leonardo DiCaprio's character in the film, is just evil. Just an evil rich dude who gets eviler and richer. And at the end of the film, spoiler alert, they literally turn the camera on the audience as though blaming us for enjoying the spectacle and encouraging people like him. I mean, Jordan Belfort, the character and the person, they're both real life people, has a lot of the same foibles that Ted Noy did. They had a similar kind of trajectory. They are both genius businessmen who fall and rebuild and fall and rebuild. But my God, Ted Noy shaped an entire ethnic community and could not see the point in anything. I mean, this is a wonderful story for sure, but one of the reasons I would love to see it as a movie is because it also hits on the theme of depression in Asians, which is often ignored due to cultural reasons. I'm really picturing this film as Wolf of Wall Street with heart and no cynicism. What do you think?
I mean, I love this story. I think it's incredibly, just, it's a thrilling story. I love the sort of twist that, like, the first part is just this Romeo and Juliet.
It's literally Romeo and Juliet. It's Romeo and Juliet. That's crazy.
It's this Cambodian Romeo and Juliet. I mean, I love that, yeah, because I love how it starts as Romeo and Juliet, and then it literally just becomes, you know, like Wolf of Wall Street, Citizen Kane, this tale of a powerful, well, you know, semi-powerful man's downfall. So what do I think about this film being like the corrective to Wolf of Wall Street? Yeah, you do get the sense that Wolf of Wall Street is just, I mean, it takes a real pleasure in telling the story about decadence and excess and, you know, bad men who do things that, you know, we all wish we could do. But I don't think it has any real insight or any real importance to that narrative. So what's your vision for this film? Do you have a director in mind?
This is an important Cambodian story, you know, with the genocide in the background, which, by the way, the USA still needs to take responsibility for, but, you know, moving on. I mean, not moving on, but moving on with this subject. The only prominent-ish Cambodian director I can think of is Hong Kao, who is a screenwriter also and did a film with my fave Ben Whishaw about a gay interracial romance and its cultural barriers. Oh, that's kind of like an abstract way of describing it. You should just like rent it on iTunes or whatever. It's called Lilting. But I mean, like, on the other hand, his filmmaking is
a bit indie.
Yeah, I feel like it does. This kind of story does require like the urgency of a film, which, like Wolf of Wall Street, which had that urgency.
I mean, I would watch a Martin Scorsese directed version of this story, like maybe with a different screenwriter than Terrence Winter, who did The Wolf of Wall Street. And just seems to be perpetually drawn to projects about women like flashing their boobs at powerful men. I mean, the way you tell this story, it's so long form and it's, you know, I mean, he's still alive, so it's still ongoing that, I mean, I think this would be an incredible and really entertaining film, but I also think it could even work maybe as like a mini series, or because it is such a multifaceted story and there's so many different chapters. The subject of this story was a very flawed and proud but also deeply troubled man, but like there is a real level of I think, as you said, like, you know, he did do a lot of good for a lot of people, so I think it's a very nuanced tale about how sometimes the people who act heroically and do great things are nursing their own troubles and their own, downfalls or whatever.
I think what is really amazing about him is that he keeps failing, but the way he builds himself back up is through doing good.
Yeah, I think he's just a really layered character who's not like necessarily just like some like gruff anti-hero or some smirking villain. You know, he's a full dimensional human being who, you know, had troubles but also had a lot of highlights of his life.
This is a monumental opportunity for an ethnically Chinese actor. There really aren't a lot of well-known Cambodian male actors, although weirdly there's quite a few mixed female ones, including Elodie Young, who was so underused and wasted in Daredevil. I guess just on like a casting note, I should clarify to people, there's a difference between like a nationality and ethnicity. Mm-hmm. So in Cambodia, you can be Cambodian, but you might be Chinese. So there's a bunch of ethnic groups in Cambodia. There's like Khmer people, ethnic Vietnamese people, ethnic Chinese people, but they would all identify as Cambodian or Vietnamese Cambodian, Chinese Cambodian, etc. So we would primarily want an actor who is of Chinese ethnicity because that was a defining feature of Ted Noy's youth. And that's why he was sent to Phnom Penh in the first place. Also, what I'm trying to get out here is if we can't find a Chinese Cambodian, we should just give this role to Benedict Wong because he needs his Oscar. He is amazing. Okay, so somebody give him a good role so like I don't compromise on my activism. So here's a monologue I may or may not have written for Benedict Wong. We're in a Gamblers Anonymous meeting and Nathie will be playing Ted Noy.
I remember the last time I saw Phnom Penh. It was a hot morning, hotter than usual. In fact, the first time I arrived, there was a kind of electric feeling in the air. But that morning, that last morning, getting tea with my colleagues from the embassy, we were interrupted by our secretary, a young local woman trembling from head to toe. I can never remember if she yelled it or if she whispered, but we all heard what she said. That the city was about to fall. We scattered like rats. Our first thought, or at least my first thought, was family. But I didn't panic. I knew I would see them again. I knew an American plane was dropping off rice in the airfield nearby. It was going to Bangkok, where my wife and children were at the time, and if the city fell, this would be my only chance at getting out. I got on my motorcycle and sped through the streets. It was like time went backwards. It was like Shiganthani was holding my waist like she had on our very first ride around the town. Shouts and whispers all around, children and parents blurring on the streets and the sidewalks, but I could not stop. I couldn't break her trust and fall. At the airfield, I hopped off the bike and I saw the plane landing. It would only be there for a few minutes, so I began to run, and that's when the rockets started raining down around us. It was already hot, my hair was singed, but the feeling of Shiganthani's arms around my waist kept me safe like a kind of fireproof vest. Time again backwards. Somehow the Americans heard me screaming over the roar and waited exactly 5 extra seconds for me to fall on board. There were scrapes all over my knees. I'd slid too hard onto the plane's carpeting. I arrived at our house in Bangkok that evening, wet from the climate, bloody, covered in dirt. It was just like the first time I came to her room in Phnom Penh. Rockets and dogs, barbed wires and war. One goal, to get to her. I knew I would see my family again because what else would I do if I didn't? And now, what's next? I don't know. And when I don't know, I fill in those gaps with what I do, the sound of roulette, the sigh of cards as they fall on the dealers' tables. And I can't stop chasing it. I'm so calm with the lights and noise bursting around me. Time going not forwards or even backwards. It's almost as though time has stopped. And my family chases me now. They look for me. They dodge the lights, the noises. They weave through the crowds. I know they will come. Because they need me. And I need to know. Why do I keep running?
Come say hi at Asian Oscar Bait on Twitter or at www.asianoscarbait.com, where we will be listing our sources. And before we end our episode, we'd like to shout out the new documentary, Hooligan Sparrow, about a female rights activist in China who is threatened at every turn for helping sexually abused school children, now on Netflix.
Asian Oscar Bait is hosted by Matthew Ang and Melissa Powers, produced by Caroline Pinto, with music by Rina Minagishi and marketing by Alina Haim.